At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a book that came out this year by Amanda Tyler, who's a lead organizer of Christians Against Christian Nationalism. And she's also one of the heads over at the Baptist Justice Commission. Is it a commission? But anyway, this is some sort of like religious liberty organization that advocates for everyone's religious liberty except for the Christians. That's just something that's very much obvious in their history, because she opposed the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court ruling, and she also opposed the Kennedy ruling about the football coach. That's a little bit more recent. That actually is in the book. She doesn't mention Masterpiece in the book at all. But we're going to be talking about her book, How to End Christian Nationalism, which I have in the print version, and it's by Amanda Tyler, who there's a lot to talk about with her. She testified in Congress, and she does tell that story in the book. It's not interesting, by the way, but she's the head of the precursor to the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. So before the Southern Baptist Convention had this, they had the BJC is what it's called, the Baptist Joint Committee, I think is what it's called. I wrote this down in my article that I've been writing, but, you know, you kind of forget because it's a pretty forgettable organization. And so she's the head of that, which is what the ERLC was made to become a Southern Baptist version of. And indeed, the Southern Baptist Convention did create their own version of this organization, because it's been run by liberals for its entire existence. And, you know, breaking news today was that Brent Leatherwood has resigned after, you know, a very incompetent and, I don't know what you want to call it, a tumultuous run as head of the ERLC. I don't know if you have any reaction to that news.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of our guys celebrating, and I don't want to throw, you know, water on the fire, but I actually
put a turd in the punch bowl.
Except, you know, sometimes you do have to open it up and drop one. And in this case, I'm actually thinking that this is a, you know, nothing ever happens type of moment with the ERLC, and that you get rid of Brent Leatherwood after he delivers you through all the turmoil of the Southern Baptist Convention in the vote that narrowly, or, you know, moderately succeeded in on their favor, where, you know, they won like 55-45 in order to stall off an effort to essentially abolish the ERLC. So they succeeded in that, and now they're okay shuffling the deck after the fact, but on their terms. And that's where I draw the distinction, that if you were a Machiavellian figure running the SPC, it's just like, okay,
they expect one of us in the wreckage, and that's Brent Leatherwood. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Leatherwood, you know, it's a good time to clean house with Leatherwood if you were a detractor of his, or if you just wanted to retain
legitimacy. What if Clint Presley disliked Leatherwood?
I mean, I imagine Leatherwood was not a good source of press for the SPC. I imagine he probably has other feelings about Bart Barber.
Well, Barber reason. Was, you know, a backer of Leatherwood, but Clint Presley might not have been. But it's interesting because the Southern Baptist Convention created an organization to compete with the organization that Amanda Tyler now heads. But the Southern Baptist Convention largely had the same results, where they created an organization that does not advocate for Christian religious liberty, but advocates for mosques to be built, and was nowhere when churches were getting shut down by the government in 2020. So it's interesting that they have the same result.
So my understanding is they work a lot with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, which is basically the liberal progressive Baptist, not even the moderate ones.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of female pastors that are interviewed in this book is like insane. Like, I think there's more women pastors consulted and interviewed for this book than there are men pastors or manlet pastors, whatever you want to call these people. So I thought that was pretty interesting. If you're thinking that Amanda Tyler takes on Stephen Wolf's case for Christian nationalism and writes a critique of it, you'd be wrong.
No, she didn't do the reading.
She did not do the reading. In fact, she does very little of addressing what the other side believes. So you'll be surprised that her worldview, like, she is the... I inject Rachel Maddow into my veins. She's not an online person, you could tell. Like, she's not in tune with what online conversations are. So she's not familiar with online discourse. She's not familiar with, you know, Christian nationalist literature like Stephen Wolf's book. And, you know, Doug Wilson doesn't even get a name drop in this. So, like, a lot of major figures are not even brought up. Al Mohler doesn't even get a name drop in this. Like, she mentions Franklin Graham, Robert Jeffress, and I'm trying to think of who else. But, like, on that level, I guess they get brought up. And her primary examples of Christian nationalism are people like Michael Flynn. So there's nothing... It's a straw man argument is what this entire thing is based off of. It's not really based on, hey, I'm going to prove why Stephen Wolf is wrong and we're going to prove how we can, you know, stop Christian nationalism. It doesn't do that at all. So she, and going back to what I said about her, like, inject that Rachel Maddow right into my veins. Like, she has, like, the liberal view of January 6th. And that's a huge driving factor in her book.
That's why she would cite, yes, Michael Flynn specifically. Because Michael Flynn was very much active in a lot of, like, you know, political campaigns, especially in the midterm elections. He was a big deal. And he's generally a lot of who is cited by the opposition when they're going more after the, I guess, what would be charismatic Christian nationalism. I don't know what you want to call it. So you can, like, but a lot of the Seven Mountain Mandate or this more dominionist, this Sean Foyt, this Bethel version. Obviously, that's maybe why. And Jeffries would be more of the, I guess, the Zionist faction. But
yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, does she? Well, the short answer is she does not even attempt to really address the other side's arguments. That's just the short answer, but. Does she even really spend that much time addressing straw man arguments? And I would say the answer to that is no. Also, like, she's not, like, creating arguments of what Christian nationalists believe. She's definitely not citing any like, there's occasionally, you know, she cites Marjorie Taylor Greene towards the end. She cites a statement from Mike Johnson that we'll talk about in the end. And Michael Flynn, which is more towards the beginning of the book. And I'm like, is she ever going to address, like, cite a Christian nationalist source on what they believe and why they believe it? And the answer to that question is no. She will ask a lot of academics. She will do a circle jerk of other authors who have written books on Christian nationalism in the negatory.
But now, does that include Paul Miller or?
I think it does include their book, although he had a co-author on his book. So I want to say yes to that, but yeah, there's that, I think the guy's name was like Steven something or something, but yeah, like, she cites other books that might have been more prominent in this space, but I thought it was very interesting that, yeah, there's like, you're talking to a Rachel Maddow listener, like, she's full blue anon on liberal conspiracy theories. You know, she believes in the insurrection narrative. She believes in, you know, all this, like, everything bad about Trump, I guess. So there's, that's the level of mental fortitude that this book is written by, and it shows.
Now, who is its intended audience?
That is also a good question. And I'd say it's people like her. This book is not about convincing the other side. It's not about, it is a strictly I'm preaching to the choir type of book. And it's not about providing a concise resource for the next generation or anything like that. This is, you know, if I have to go on Rachel Maddow and talk about how to end Christian nationalism, I have like 8 steps, and these are the 8 steps that I'd tell on a program. And much of the book is kind of filler other than that. But yeah, that's a good question as to who the intended audience is. Like, I think it's just people like her, like, or it's the class of people who would read this book. Like, this book could just be like a speaking circuit book. Like, there's no, this book is just intended to get distributed if she's speaking at a conference or something like that. This book, I don't think, is really
planned her conference gig.
Yes.
Which then
yes.
monetizes her name and brand.
Like, people don't make money off of books these days like they used to anyway. Let's just be clear about that. But this book, yeah, I don't think it's intended to be a bestseller or anything like that. It's intended to probably get her on speaking gigs.
It is its own credential system. Some, you know, whatever publisher published the book and then her name on the book. And then that's a credential in and of itself.
The sticker price is like $27.99. Is what it says on the book cover, like how expensive the book is. But I paid less for that because I think I either found like a used copy or something else. It's Broadleaf Books in Minneapolis is the publisher. So Minneapolis, yeah, they're renowned for, you know, just Christian businesses and stuff like that. So, yeah. So, another thing that's worth mentioning is that, Amanda Tyler, she's married to a Jewish husband. Just worth mentioning that she's like not even Christian in the sheets, let alone she's not Christian in the streets either. So she's unequally yoked in her own household. And I think that undermines her entire credibility that, you know, she doesn't believe that the Bible's authoritative in her life. And it also explains why she has such a devotion to religious pluralism. Because that's really what she's devoted to. Like, she's interested in preserving religious pluralism. She's not actually interested in the Great Commission or justice or anything like that. So, all right. Let's get to the first clip. Not clip. We're not doing clips. We're just doing screen caps of a book. So, you know, the nice tagline I use is, I'm reading this so you don't have to. And, you know, there's some entertainment value into this. I actually found this book easy to read. Like, it's not too advanced for me. And I think I'm the type of guy that has a easier time reading things I disagree with than I do reading things that I'm inclined to agree with. Because I still have not finished Joe Rigney's book. So, anyway. And the first impression that I got of this book, this is on page 3. Where she says, we will not end Christian nationalism if Christians do not actively work to dismantle it, to rid it from ourselves, our congregations, and our larger communities. For Christians who are committed to this cause, basing our activism in our faith provides the motivation and the sustenance to persevere in this hard work. And make no mistake, this will not be an easy road. Christian nationalism is deeply entrenched in U.S. society because generations have let Christian nationalism fester. The ideology has grown deep roots, creating an underground system that makes it that much harder to extricate. Nor can this outcome, ending Christian nationalism, be accomplished in my lifetime or yours. We must accept a problem that has gone unaddressed for centuries will take several generations to resolve. This book offers a starting place for each person to contribute to this multi-generational project. It does not, however, make false promises about how smoothly or quickly this work will go. So that was a quote from page 3. So this is in the introduction, and I am just stunned by how defeatist and demoralized this sounds. Like, this is not a book that has an optimistic outlook on the material within. So that was my first impression, and you love to see that.
No, I find it shocking that it has the approach that this stuff has been around for a while rather than trying to take the novel approach, which I think if you were to argue that it's novel, it would be more persuasive, regardless of whether or not novelty is true or not. Again, Stephen Wolfe would not argue that novel, that his ideas are novel in any sense of the word, even within the American tradition. And, you know, obviously you could argue that theonomy is very reconstructionist. That's their own, you know, terminology. So you might argue that that is a novelty, especially, you know, Doug Wilson's brand of it is historically novel and also libertarian, which, you know, ironic.
Historically given, novel.
Yes, but also kind of ironic given Rush Dooney's own thoughts towards libertarianism. But
which are?
Negative, because he thinks it's materialistic.
Okay. So he hates Ayn Rand, right?
Probably.
Okay.
But yeah, instead of going for the it's the novel, she assumes that it is historically present or prevailing or just like always there.
Yeah, she kind of views it as like a battle that's always being waged. And she goes back to Constantine, for instance. And of course, she would have the ignorant position that Constantine would have been like the first person to declare a nation Christian. No, that honor belongs to Tiridates III of Armenia.
Oh, man.
Persecuted the Zoroastrians, by the way. Because he was a Chad like that. Even Christian Post just wrote an article discussing that. Interestingly enough. So, you're right. She doesn't appeal to the tradition that this is, you know, she doesn't appeal to tradition saying that Christian nationalism is alien to tradition. And that is actually a weak starting place for her argument.
But again, not only can she not, I mean, her entire, I won't say worldview, but yeah, her entire belief system is itself invented or certainly pervasive in the last 100 years. And, you know, this is not just a post-war consensus is her belief system, but even just, you know, feminism going back to essentially the French Revolution. But that's her belief system. It has zero roots in history outside of, you know, the whole egalitarian push.
Yeah, I mean, there's that meme of like a view of Christian history and it's like, oh, the early church had it the best, you know, they're the best. And then Constantine happened and everything was
there was no
up.
Church until and like then Martin Luther, but
Martin Luther, Luther King. And then Martin wow. Luther King rescued the church, you know, with his 95 theses. And yeah, that's sort of her view of church history. Like, the church got it wrong until Martin Luther King delivered his 95, 99 theses or whatever. I get that. Yeah, Didymus is saying sort of Arianism is not as bad as Islam. That is true. That is true. But yes, I think that Tiridates was based for, nonetheless.
Also, that was before Islam.
Yeah, that would have been before. That would have been like in the year 312, give or take. So that might have been slightly before Milvian Bridge or the Edict of Milan. So anyway, she does not appeal to tradition, and she talks about Christian nationalism being both simultaneously rejected and embraced in America's founding. So I guess that's sort of the next thing that there is to talk about, because this would be the introduction. And yeah, I just took this as she's very defeated. She sounds defeated. And that's a good thing. Like, I want her to think that she's an underdog that has no chances of winning. Like, that's fine by me. She has my permission to think that. So, the other thing, and let me pull up page 28, and because the first chapter is like, how do we defeat Christian nationalism? Well, we have to take away its historic, you know, its understanding of history. She thinks that Christian nationalism is built on a mythical founding of America as a Christian nation. But keep in mind, there's like several ways to view a nation as being Christian. We can certainly list, you know, nations in the Middle East as, you know, no one would question the statement that, you know, Jordan is a Islamic nation or a Muslim nation. Like, no one would question that. in the same way that people would not question that America was a Christian nation in 1776 because it was not a Muslim nation. It was not a Buddhist nation like the Japanese were. So stuff like that, but you know, and it wasn't whatever Haiti was, but anyway, so she doesn't have like a historical grounding for the term Christian nation as, yeah, this is the religion of this people group, which is how a historian would talk about it. Let's see. Actually, I'll read this paragraph. After Constantine, the faith of Jesus morphed into the practice of European Christianity that used power to gain control by oppression. We should not overlook or underestimate the lasting impact this use of power to enforce and propagate Christianity has had on the integrity of the Christian faith. In other words, because of Christian nationalism, there has been an ever-widening gap between the teachings of Jesus and the religion of Christianity. So, yes, she is of the impression that Constantine was Christian nationalism, and that is where everything went wrong. And that's on page 28 of her book. And I'm just like, you do realize that the church exploded in a good way, not as in the Islamic way, but in a good way in the 4th century with Constantine taking control of the Roman Empire. Like, the church exploded. And additionally, it was Emperor Constantine who called the Council of Nicaea, which settled the issue of the Trinity.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people will, you know, bash
and Christology as well.
A lot of people will bash sacralism, even though I'd like to know what creeds or confessions could you affirm if they were inherently, like, I guess, sacralistic in their origins. I mean, obviously they were commissioned by magistrates or emperors or kings or parliaments, but all of these institutions throughout the centuries instituted the confessions and the creeds. That's where we get them from. The church did not organically create most of the important creeds. And obviously, you know, the Catholic position would be that, you know, the Pope commissioned all the councils and creeds, which obviously, you know, they did some in the Reformation, or Council of Trent would be a good example, but that's also where they made that claim. So yeah, but yeah, all the important creeds and councils were all, except for Jerusalem, instituted by the magistrates. And of course, Westminster Confession would be another one, London Baptist Confession, that would be one. So a lot of them were Augsburg and Heidelberg, I think, were commissioned by their respective magistrates. So, I mean, it's just throughout history. You couldn't really affirm anything except, again, the Baptist faith, the message, or the Lausanne Covenant, if you wanted like an English confession or creed that wasn't in some part fashioned by a state or commissioned at
the behest of the United States. I think J.D. Hall is an interesting argument about Lausanne or whatever it's called. It's Switzerland, so I don't really care. This is the next paragraph where it gets to the America part. I didn't realize that the Constantine part was like in the middle, the most laughable part of her understanding of history, because it gets more laughable than just that. Because basically it's like all of Christianity got it wrong for, like, you know, there wasn't any, yeah, everything went wrong, and then Martin Luther King Jr. came.
So that is the embodiment of liberal progressive Christianity. Yep. Everything was wrong until me.
In the U.S. context, Christian nationalism was present before the nation's inception. European invaders of this continent, so they're invaders, were armed not with, just with weapons and disease, but also the blessing of the church in the form of the Doctrine of Discovery, a series of papal bulls that justified the seizure of land inhabited by people who were not Christians, all in the name of God. So, fun story, you know, the papal.
So is that about the Crusades, or is that
no? So the Pope divided the earth between what the Portuguese could take and
that's what that's referencing. Okay,
yeah, colonial and the Spanish,
based and in Brazil.
The Portuguese asked for the line to be drawn a little bit more to the west, and I guess they claimed that Brazil was part of, you know, on their side of the line, and then the Spanish, you know, somehow it's a little bit to the right, so they could get the Philippines and stuff like that. So there's like a whole line system for how the the Pope kind of divided territories. And then the English kind of like, tear that up. Yeah, we're not listening to that. And Spanish Armada happened anyway. So, you know, they ruled the seas. The queen rules the seas, or king, I guess. Depending on who the monarch. It would have been Queen Elizabeth during that point. But anyway. Yeah, this is not really a reference to America's founding other than the state of Florida. So this is stupid to bring up. But also the conquistadors were based.
It's
and
an
the good
argument
guys.
Against colonialism, that Christianity led to colonialism. Colonialism is bad. Therefore, Christianity, that was Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism, bad. That's kind of the whole.
Yeah, I mean, America was settled by the Protestants of the English side, you know, the British Isles and then the Netherlands. Because the Dutch settled in places like Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Amsterdam. So, yeah. It's just an asinine read of history that you're going to Catholic examples for the continental United States when the Catholics don't matter outside of the Florida.
But you're using it because you're intrinsically arguing that colonialism is bad.
Yes.
And evil. And yes. This great sin. Even though, again, your entire existence as a human being is because of colonialism. Everything in your kitchen pantry is probably because of colonialism. Like, that's how much food spread throughout the globe. Because every nation, every culture had their cuisine altered because of the Columbian Exchange.
And their fashion. Like, what you think of as traditional fashion in China is, like, Western designed. Hawaiian culture is almost entirely based on American tourism. Like, that is, like, the basis for all the Hawaiian cultures. Like, everything that you associate Hawaii with is, like, because of colonial tourism. So, yeah, we gave a lot of culture.
I guess having human sacrifice and cannibalisms and just barbarous savagery in the North and South Americas is far superior than Christian nationalism.
And then she continues. We're still on page 28. We're at the last paragraph. Christian nationalism ebbed and flowed throughout U.S. history, with its highs at certain moments in the generation after the founding. See the Naturalization Act of 1790, which restricted citizenship to white persons. The years preceding the Civil War, the division of Christian denominations along North-South lines over the issue of slavery, which the South was actually theologically correct about, by the way. The years after population expansion due to immigration, see the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The years following Reconstruction, see the rapid growth of the Ku Klux Klan in the early 20th century. The Red Scare, the 1950s, see the adoption of In God We Trust as the national motto, and Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance. In all these instances, Christian nationalism flourished because it was a prevalent ideology, but also its adherents held power and used it in law and policy, with actions taken and not taken. The same is true today. Christian nationalism is flourishing both because it is a pervasive ideology and because it is a well-funded political movement. Though it can be tempting to focus on the movement aspect of Christian nationalism, I think our efforts will be better directed at dismantling the ideology, which is admittedly a much more difficult task. So,
I mean, can we just go through her read of history? It's just like, yeah, let's start with the Chinese Exclusion Act, which actually prevented Chinese people from being exploited and undercutting American wages. So it was absolutely justified to prevent them from coming here and stealing jobs and or just basically being slaves, except with like menial wages and doing a lot of the dangerous jobs that probably would have been done much safer, with white labor. And though, obviously white people wanted to have higher wages if they're going to be handling nitroglycerin and dynamite and making tunnels for trains. But yeah, I mean, and again, I don't think they were actually allowed to be citizens if they had children here. The whole anchor, like they couldn't anchor baby their children under the, even prior to the Chinese Exclusion Act. So again, that was a good law. It was necessary for the, essentially to prevent them from being exploited, but also to prevent American jobs from being undercut. So yeah, As for the Ku Klux Klan, well, if you actually understand the history of Reconstruction, the Ku Klux Klan rose as basically vigilante justice because the South was basically under the tyranny of Reconstruction. And, you know, they had these illegitimate governors established by the federal government. They had lack of courts, lack of ability to self-rule because they're essentially under military occupation. So you had a lot of lawlessness. And that's where vigilante groups like the KKK come in and basically try to rebalance the scales. And that's after you have a massive financial crisis because no one can afford their farm. So you get this, you get all the carpetbaggers coming from the North buying basically foreclosures.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
So yeah, you had that going on. So yeah, that's why organizations like the KKK rose, regardless of what their later origins are. Yeah, the law, the 1790 immigration law, totally necessary.
And it was good. And we'll get to that more in a second, because she has a view of history that, you know, we'll get to that when we talk about her view of the First Amendment, because I thought that there was just such a hilarious irony to this. And I'm trying to find the quote where she calls the pre-Columbian civilizations highly developed.
Now, can we just, like, going back to 1790 law, can we just, like, point that out, that Joel Berry doesn't want to acknowledge that that was what the founding fathers actually believed?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of debates about America and America's founding, but one thing that's not debatable, and the one thing that they were extremely unified on, they wanted a white European nation.
Well, I mean,
specifically just Anglo-Saxon in heritage. Maybe they would have allowed a couple Frenchies in there.
Well, I mean, yeah, they probably would have been fine with the French.
Or the Germans a little bit, because, you know, the Hessians immigrated or assimilated. So maybe a little bit, because, you know, what we think of as Anglos and Saxons came from the German areas. So, yeah, they probably would have just limited it that part of Europe. So, you know, Dutch welcomed as well. So they were actually unified on that question and some other things. I mean, but they were not very unified elsewise. And I do want to read the Bishop of Railway. $5. The French Catholics lay the groundwork for the English in the North. Champlain was based. And I don't know that latter reference, but yes, he is right. The French Catholics laid the groundwork for, like, the Canadians and stuff like that. And they also provided, like, a safe harbor for Catholics to kind of escape the Revolutionary War, as well as they were also, the Quebec Act was one of the biggest grievances of the Americans and the colonials, because the British gave westward expansion rights to the Quebec province instead of the 13 colonies, which was actually one of the biggest grievances leading to the War of Independence, because we wanted westward expansion and we didn't want the Canadians, Catholics, to control the Ohio Valley. So that was a huge grievance, was the spread of religion in the frontier. They wanted it to be Protestant and not Catholic. So there's a lot of religious causes to war. And as far as the American War of Independence go, the Quebec Act was in some ways a religious war.
Then you have the Proclamation of 1763, which basically was the line that drew the line at the Appalachians.
Right. And then, yes, because of the Ohio Valley being beyond that, that was then given in the Quebec Act, which was a punitive measure, if I believe. It was part of the Intolerable Acts. So, yeah. But Quebec, they were, I believe, invited to the Continental Congress. They declined. So, yeah. You know, even despite these disagreements, they were still invited to the Continental Congress. Maybe because, you know, they weren't, you know, it wasn't necessarily the initial intention to declare independence and stuff like that. So little bit of a history lesson, but I'm trying to find the quote where she called pre-Columbian civilizations highly developed, and you know, talked about how it was so, you know, there's
I will say one of the most
laughable reads of history.
Well, that's one of the tropes of liberalism, the classical version of it, this Enlightenment era nonsense, is the noble savage, where, you know, underneath every person is just an Englishman just waiting to come out, that all people are interchangeable, all races are the same. There's, you know, there's nothing innate within a group of people, within, you know, the culture, which is an outgrowth of that group of people, that would prevent them from assimilating. Or at least assimilating at scale. And again, yeah, the Democrats will make outlandish claims about the Indians. Though they were peaceful. No, they were bloody savages.
I mean, think James Cameron's Avatar movie but they actually believe that that was real life.
Yes. I mean, I remember it was the 2020 Democrat National Convention, and you had someone saying that they had democracy in North America before Columbus. And this was like the Apache or whatever those tribes in the, I guess it would be New Mexico were. It's just like, no, that's entirely untrue. Like Bone Tomahawk was far more accurate depiction of what those tribes were like than some Democrat utopia that didn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, again, in Alabama, they had a savage Indian attack that, you know, where they just massacred 500 people. And yeah, they got avenged.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of that. Were. Especially as after the initial, you know, after I want to say King Philip's War, but definitely when the British used Native Americans to fight the American colonials, that's really when the animosity kind of really ramps up. It's not like Assassin's Creed 3 where it's like, yeah, we're going to support the Americans because it's going to work out for us. I mean, that was a minority position as far as the natives go. And the reality is the British used them as proxies to fight the Americans, and that persisted through the War of 1812, which is often regarded as America's Second War of Independence. The British, they didn't exactly know how to defeat the Americans, but they knew how to burn our capital. We could take America's capital, but, you know, it's not Europe. That doesn't end the war. So, you know, burning DC, capturing Philadelphia didn't do anything. So with that said, her view of history is just laughable. And then we combine that with her understanding of the First Amendment, because she kind of goes in with this naive notion that the First Amendment is about religious liberty for all religions to come to the United States and stuff like that. But she does have a reality check, and the reality check is not her own writing. It's a quote that she gets from a professor that she interviewed that's not an American, because her name is Aziz. So I'm going to assume that they're non-American. And it was, the First Amendment was not conceived in a context like today, where you literally have people of different religions living together and having to figure out how we set rules and have a system in place that allows us to coexist and not force each other to follow each other's religion or punish each other for not following each other's religion. Aziz told me they're a completely different context. Aziz's perspective is important to consider because it complicates a triumphant narrative of religious freedom. Though they talked in grandiose terms about religious freedom, the framers did not have our current reality in mind when they drafted these principles. By confining citizenship to white persons, when the overwhelming majority of the existing population was white Protestant, they were effectively limiting the potential religious diversity that they would allow to have access to the promise of religious freedom. Aziz explained that ensuring religious freedom has always required advocacy by those who were trying to realize the rights promised in the Constitution. Testing religious liberty norms comes from the early 1900s onward, in large part in the courts and to have some extent in politics, she told me. Oh, so Aziz is a chick. The reality is that religious liberty isn't expanded to other groups out of the kindness of the hearts of those who are in control. So, yes, that was actually a correct take from this book on history, and it doesn't come from the author. It comes from a professor that she talks to, and that professor correctly identifies that the founding fathers did not believe in, they did not want a multicultural goop of religion in their country because they knew that that was a stupid idea. Like, everyone knows that you can't have a multicultural society and expect it to work. Like, the people that really try to do multiculturalism, it doesn't end well for them. Like, you know, look at Napoleon. Let me have a grand army invade Russia. Several nations take part, and it doesn't work out well for them, in part because they were multicultural. Smaller French army would have defeated the Russians in Russia. That, just my analysis of that, because they were too large to give battle. Like, the Russians would just retreat because they're hopelessly outnumbered. We're not going to fight. So they got bogged down, and they were too slow because they were large. But anyway, and then, you know, Austria-Hungary in World War I was multinational, and that didn't help them out. Also, Austria in the Austro-Prussian War, multinational, doesn't work. So the Founding Fathers weren't trying to create this. They were really just, again, going back to what we said, they were actually very unified on creating a white European nation. And
yeah, I mean,
that was the context of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, okay, we're going to give religious freedom, but only because we have the population that we have.
I mean, she's also assuming that you should want Muslims and Hindus and whatever else living next to you in a society, and that that would improve your society by having diversity. That diversity is a noble pursuit in and of itself. And, you know, the world is diverse, so therefore the world must come to you. You must have everything that is in the world in your neighborhood. And that was the chief end of mankind. That's just a ridiculous, like, premise. You should want to have a multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multi-whatever society. Like, just because.
Yes, she thinks that is a promise of the Founding Fathers.
Yeah, that they wanted to create some United Nations.
Well, for, you know, a place for every culture to be except theirs.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't care how these, you know, the idea of the First Amendment even comes about. She doesn't care about how the history that goes all the way back to, like, Magna Carta, probably even longer if you really wanted to, of, like, limited government or the idea of restraining the monarch. Like, she doesn't care about any of that, which, again, only comes out of the English tradition. And that's why a lot of the way the English treated colonialism was why the English colonies were far more successful than the Spanish and the French colonies. So again, yeah, it's specific to English culture, not just white European.
The French weren't exactly interested in, like, colonial, like, they were interested in, like, fur trading and stuff like that, but they were not very big on, hey, we're going to settle on a new land and stuff like that. Like, they weren't very big on that. The Spanish did a little bit more of that, but they were very much more about integrating and syncretizing. You know, that's more.
They were a little hot-blooded Latins, if you know what I'm saying. Because, you know, they did some mating.
And
some
they were very much bigger on intermating, that's for sure, than the English were. And then the Dutch kind of lost a few wars, but they were kind of doing more along the lines of what the English were doing. So the English and the Dutch were kind of doing the same thing. The Dutch just lost too many wars. And then, I guess Portuguese were a little bit more like the Spanish.
But she doesn't necessarily care about any of the history that went into the First Amendment. She just thinks, oh, this should exist just because. You know, it's kind of like it's almost very female-coded, where it's like you turn the light switch on and then the lights come on, but you don't necessarily know about any of the steps or the processes that were necessary so that when you flip the switch, the light comes on.
Right. And, you know, she's trying to justify having a light bulb that doesn't work in the light you know, the socket or whatever. Because that's kind of what we have now is like, yeah, the founding fathers weren't trying to create a secular neutrality. They weren't trying to do that. The first word of the First Amendment is Congress, or the Establishment Clause. It's Congress. So this is really a limitation on the power of Congress. This is about Congress not deciding what is established as a religion. The states are free to if they want to. But Congress is not, because Congress is going to respect the pan-Protestant creation that we have here that actually is an experiment. That you could have a little bit more pan-Protestantism than, say, what the Germans had going for them in the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire. So you actually could have that. And then, her view of the Founding Fathers, I just think is, you know, they suck because they're racist, but, you know, they resisted Christian nationalism. She kind of has this both going on here, but she can't avoid that the Naturalization Act of 1790.
Which, again, would have had to have been signed by none other than George Washington.
Right. And we're at least I remember being taught in public schools that this went against the Founding Fathers' vision. And it's like, It clearly didn't, because it was the Founding Fathers who ratified that bill.
It's literally signed by the guy on the $1 bill.
Yeah. So clearly it didn't undermine their vision. It was completely in line with their vision, and it's one of the first acts of Congress in the grand scheme of our nation's history. So I thought this part was just funny, because this is another rare moment of self-awareness in this book. So we got kind of the laughable history. Then there's some self-awareness in terms of history. Let's talk about the theology of the book. Because, again, if you're expecting a grand theological argument, I read the part where she said that she was going to... I think I read the part where she said she was more going to focus on tearing down Christian nationalism as an ideology. She does not do that at all. There's no exegesis on, say, Romans 13 on the powers of the state. It is all just empty platitudes. And this is a very good section that kind of highlights my point that this is all empty platitudes. It's like white supremacy is a sin, or white supremacy is bad. Therefore, we must oppose Christian nationalism. Like, that's literally her level of argumentation. But this is a little bit more advanced than that. This section is, but not by much. So we have a free will argument going on here, where she starts off arguing about free will means that religious pluralism, or because God gave us free will, which again is from our perspective, not God's perspective. Therefore, secular neutrality is the ideal form of government. Like, that's her argument. So picking up from there, she says, with freedom, though, comes responsibility and accountability. So she's trying to do the Spider-Man quote.
She's really asserting that women, like, you know, accountability, reason and accountability. Very feminine virtues, right?
Yeah. Sure. The humans in the creation story also suffered the consequences of the decisions they made with their freedoms. Despite all our imperfections and mistake, we are children of God. Recognizing the divine image in each person is the first step to loving our neighbor. If I had to sum up Christianity in one word, that word would be love. When a lawyer asks Jesus the question about the greatest commandment, Jesus first quotes the Torah's Deuteronomy instruction to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, and with all your mind. And then Jesus adds a twist. Another way to see that commandment in our earthly context, you must love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, Jesus says, all the law and prophets depend. So that is on page 58 of her book.
And that is a generic, like, liberal Christian read. It's just, and it completely divorces the rest of the law, or the entirety of the law.
Well, yeah, when we talk about first table versus second table, which is what loving God is first table, loving your neighbor as yourself is second table.
You're loving God and loving by
because allowing... the Imago Dei is, you know, the rights of God to be, you know, the right of God to be loved by you is being fulfilled by the Imago Dei. No, that's not how it works. That doesn't excuse your duties to love God.
Yeah, that, you know, oh, the person has the right to worship the Hindu statue in Texas means that that's love to allow them to do that.
I'm defending their religion. I'm defending their paganism. Therefore,
which
I'm
not even
I'm loving God and doing that.
Which is not even consistent with what Jesus says.
But anyway, let's point out the fact that she doesn't cite the fact that she doesn't recognize that Jesus quoted Leviticus 19 in loving your neighbor as yourself. That is from Leviticus 19, sandwiched between two Bible chapters that make unambiguous condemnations of homosexuality. So she says that Jesus adds a twist to the law. And that's not what Jesus did. Jesus said this was the first and greatest commandment. And then Jesus said, and the second is this. You know, Jesus did not create on the spot that law. I mean, he is the lawgiver. Yeah, that's what J.D. Hall is kind of trolling me on. Is like, he is the lawgiver. Obviously, my, you know, Jesus juke there. But, yeah, Jesus didn't make that up on the spot. It was, you know, Jesus did give new commandments. But those were not the new commandments that he gave. It was like, you know, loving one another and stuff like that.
Which is largely about how the church is supposed to love those within the church.
Right.
Which, again, is more of a expansion upon the, you know, first and second greatest commandments.
So, but this is the vacuous level of theology that she has. Everyone's a child of God, and therefore me protecting their right to practice idolatry is loving my neighbor as myself because they have the image of God, and therefore I'm also loving God when I protect my neighbor's ability to practice idolatry.
I mean, this is again the problem with just the concept of rights as a concept, or these idea of inalienable rights, which I understand is in, you know, it's in the Declaration, but, you know, Thomas Jefferson was wrong. He was incorrect. And again, I don't think the signers of the Declaration were as concerned with that one paragraph as they were the rest of the actual grievances which they were levying against the crown. And again, as the Constitutional Convention later confirmed, and of course the first acts of Congress in 1790, they did not actually believe in the notion of universal rights as is commonly understood today, where you have these human rights that exist inalienable, that no matter what you do or what you are entitled to rights. No, you're not. The Bible is not a book of rights. It is a book of laws. It is a book of commandments. You have duties and obligations to God. You do not have rights, or if you do have rights, they are contingent upon you fulfilling your duty. I mean, you don't even have the right to bear arms from God. You have a duty of self-preservation. And again, that's Samuel Rutherford, if you want to just have one source on that. But yes, that's generally the Christian thought, is that you have a duty of self-preservation, not necessarily a right to self-defense. Again, they call it duties and they don't call them rights. And we are very obsessed with the notion of rights, even though, again, if you don't fulfill your duty, should you have the rights? And I would say no.
And then, where do I want to move on from here? Because I'm kind of just going through a lot of the pictures and screenshots that I've snagged, because, you know, those are more interesting parts of the book. There's a lot of underlying context. And then after, you know, butchering the First Amendment, she does take a more practical approach to dealing with like public schools and stuff like that. And yeah, I actually think that she does like an own goal type of situation, because when I look at this paragraph here, like, she's a very obsessed with making sure that we don't have prayer in school, that, you know, the Kennedy, you know, Coach Kennedy was wrong for what he did, and, you know, Sonia Sotomayor got that case right, because she cites her. And, you know, in the midst of all that, she kind of gives us a strategy for the public schools. So I thought this was another interesting excerpt from the book, because part of what I'm doing here is opposition research. And what do they think? How do they think that they can defeat us? And the answer is, I don't have an answer to how they think that we can defeat, they can be defeated. I got one section that I'll read from the book where it's like, wow, she finally gave more practical advice. But what's funny is she gives us a playbook for how to twist a knife in them, and specifically on the issue of public schools. So I actually thought that this was a good idea that we should take from her book and implement unironically. Another legal fight that Dr. Chansey anticipates is the move towards offering school credit for religious courses taken during what's commonly known as release time. This is a long-standing practice in U.S. public education in which time set aside during school hours for students to receive off-campus religious education. I think that's going to explode and the movement is going to grow, he said. You end up with the state giving academic credit potentially for a course that teaches that Muslims are going to hell, or that students that Jews, or teaches students that Jews killed Jesus, or that the earth was created in six days, 6,000 years ago. And if you have the state recognizing that coursework with credit, this is fraught with all sorts of problems. So I think that this is an excellent strategy for Christians to pursue an education, some sort of concurrent enrollment, like off-campus credit. Like, obviously it should not be an AP credit, and it shouldn't be it probably shouldn't be an honors level credit, but if it wants to be a simple generic elective credit, I think this is a very good idea to pursue, and churches should, you know, get on board once this is done to actually disciple and catechize students.
That actually is a very interesting idea. I'm not quite sure if it's how feasible it is. I mean, obviously you see a lot of states doing the whole put the Ten Commandments in the classroom, which, you know,
she talks a lot about that.
It's a good idea, and symbolically, of course, I'm more.
And concerned. Texas passed that this year, didn't they?
I believe so. Then you have like you need to have the KJV in the schools, which, you know, that is, I mean, every school should have a KJV just as a reference for like a library in the library, but.
Yeah, she mentions the KJV also. But yeah, she's outdated in two things. One, Trump killed the Johnson Amendment. And then two, I think Texas did eventually pass that bill, despite her glazing that state senator or whatever, that representative that claims to be a Christian. He's a bit more viral. So that is one of the more super online aspects, is her getting that guy on board. But yeah. Yeah, she does not want, you know, Christian students to receive elective credit off campus and that be counted. Like, she's opposed to that.
There's so much dead time in just like filler classes in public schools as it is. It's just like, oh, you actually have something that could be done more efficiently and better, and while also
is useful. Yeah. Is useful if done right. Like, obviously, I'm sure a Bible study class could be a giant screw around hour, but, you know, it could be useful to do like a Bible education or a catechism class as an elective credit. Like, that is useful, that is edifying. And I think that would be more academically rigorous and challenging than most high school coursework. Because I'm going to be real, when you can retake test or bring notes, you can bring just, you know, a paper of notes onto a test, you're not really being tested. Like, it's not academically rigorous if you can just take notes to a test. You know, you might as well just bring the textbook with you as well at the rate that they're going. So, and yes, KJV is a good translation. I use it in my book, Winning Not Winsome, as well. So I thought that she just kind of gave the game away by saying what we could do to, like, make it worse for her.
And again, I've not even seen anyone advocating that.
I've not, and that's why I'm like, we should totally do this, because I think that's actually a good idea, especially if we can do it right. So this is another quote. So remember when I said that this book is about, you know, each chapter is a step, and I can read the steps for you. Let me just read the table of contents so you Like, you know what the steps are. Step one, name and understand the threat of Christian nationalism. So that's where we talk about the history part. Step two, ground yourself in God's love. So that's the part where she's talking about the greatest commandment. Step three, denounce violence, which does include like rhetoric. She's like, you know, violent rhetoric is bad. So it's not just silence is violence, but words are violence.
But no justice, no peace is perfectly fine, yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah, she does not mention left-wing violence. Step four, commit to separation of church and state. I think that's where that one quote came from. Step five, take on Christian nationalism close to home. So this is where I'm reading from right here is on page 140. And it's towards the end of this chapter. So this is kind of where she's wrapping up her ideas. And she says, in other words, talking about Christian nationalism with someone close to you is similar to talking about other difficult topics. It's the best approach is humility and genuine curiosity. I've never had much success approaching a tough conversation with the end goal of making the other person see things exactly the way I see them. Trying to understand how the other person came to the views that they have will open up more opportunities for sharing. You can then share with them the opportunity, some of the reflections that you have had as you have deepened your thinking, maybe even as you work through the steps of this book, being transparent about the assumptions you have made about the past in the past, and subsequent shifts in your thinking may give an opening or permission for the other person to contemplate new possibilities for themselves. As Dr. Carty noted, it is often not just one conversation that will make the difference, but a relationship built over time with mutual sharing and learning that can lead to growth for everyone involved. So is there any practical wisdom there? It's like, just don't be argumentative.
It's basically the love. I mean, again, you'll see liberal Christians do the whole love them back to Jesus thing and like, you know, build the relationship and don't, you know, be forthright. I guess
that's what all these liberals are doing.
The gospel by building the relationship, you know,
that's what all these liberals are doing with James Lindsay, by the way.
That's the Tim Keller approach of missionary work. It doesn't work. And again, how is anything she thinks or believes at all beneficial to a white guy like me? Because again, a lot of what she's conflating with Christian nationalism is just white people identifying as white and wanting to assert their own self-interest. One might call that white supremacy. One might call that white nationalism. It doesn't really matter. I mean, again, if you look at the ADL's definition of white supremacy, the founding fathers were indeed white supremacists, according to the ADL, on all four counts that they...
All four criteria, they mean?
Yeah, well, not criteria, because they say if you check one of the boxes, but the founding fathers would probably check all four of the boxes, including genetic. But...
I mean, how's her loving her husband to the Lord going? And, you know, that's, you know, a snippy thing to say, but when you're just lecturing other Christians on their approach, I just want to know how your approach is doing.
But,
you
know.
You open that up when you try to lecture and schoolmarm people about how they should advocate ideas, you know, and stuff like that.
But, yeah.
So she opens that up.
It's but her schoolmarming is basically going to be, okay, how does anything that you're trying to counter my arguments with going to benefit me?
Like, it's I don't not. Think she has a single anecdote about convincing a Christian nationalist in this story.
It's basically the equivalent of what does Kamala Harris offer me as a voter? Nothing. Her entire platform is about taking from me. It's about denigrating me as a human. Like, if that's her entire platform, if that's, you know, in this case, that's, you know, Tyler's entire book is about denigrating white people as a people.
White Christians especially.
Yes. So how does anything she's coming at you with benefit me as a person?
Exactly. And she sort of admits that white Christians are not necessarily negatively affected the most by Christian nationalism. So she kind of, you know, she admits that, yeah, we're not really negatively affected all that much.
But again,
we are still negatively affected, but she doesn't really like provide an example.
You're negatively affected because you're a bad person, which is like the whole liberal cudgel. That's right. Like the liberal mantra.
That's why they have to label you with all these things.
Yes.
So that's chapter five. That's how she concludes chapter five. And that's like the most meaty paragraph, if you could call it that. Like that's weak sauce. but that's how taking on Christian nationalism at home. This would have been a chapter about addressing like your uncle that's a Christian nationalist, but clearly this book had like no real insight on how to do that because she does not talk to people outside of her circles, outside of her conference grift.
The family member that makes the off-color remark about all the immigrants in the neighborhood.
Yeah, like
or the black crime problem in Cincinnati.
Right. So she has no real world experience executing the stuff that she talks about. This book is the opposite of, you know, my book Winning Not Winsome, which does provide practical wisdom that in large cases I have executed either in Christian nationalism or not in Christian media or in real life. So I mean, both of those are real life, but I just wanted to kind of delineate the two. So then step six, organize for change. This is a whole glorified chapter about community organizing and its merits. Step seven, protect religious freedom in public schools. So we've kind of addressed that. Like she views this as a battleground. And then step eight, take your place in the public square. So I guess there's some practical wisdom. Don't be argumentative. Protect the schools at all cost from any sort of Christian imagery. And then, yes, taking your place in public square is vague, participate in democracy type of nonsense. And she references a lot of politicians. And yes, she's a partisan hack because there are zero Republicans in this book that are mentioned favorably. It like every politician that she mentions favorably is a Democrat. And there's just no debate about it. I do want to read, this is from the Taking Your Place in the Public Square chapter, and this is like the only practical advice that really applies to like the everyday person that I can really see in this entire book. It goes from page 197 into page 198. If you're accused of making up the term Christian nationalism, so she's trying to address people that don't think it's a real thing. Or using it as a scare tactic to silence your political opponents, I suggest sharing definitions of the term used in step one of this book. Over the past several years, there have been many excellent books and articles written about Christian nationalism, many of which I have cited in the resource section of this book, which also has helpful tools in defining and understanding the term. If your conversation partner still won't accept the term, see if you can find common ground on what the term gets at. The merging of American and Christian identities as a betrayal of both the constitutional promises and the Christian faith. Can they acknowledge that God loves all God's children equally without regard to national identity? Keep in mind when she asks that, she views pagans as God's children. So she's not
That is a classic liberal trope.
She's not using that term to mean the elect.
No, I mean, the Bible clearly says like the people that are adopted as God's, like the church is adopted as God's children. And also you could argue God does not love all equally given that he consigned some to hell and then some are chosen to be the elect. So obviously he loves the elect more than he loves the non-elect.
Yeah, I mean, that's basic logic. Because I don't think God's lovingly sending people to hell. Like, I don't think that's an act of love. I think that's an act of justice. Justice, which is an attribute of God. Justice and righteousness. These are attributes of God. And that's, we talked about that last week. Do they accept all U.S. citizens are equal without regard to religion? Do they denounce violent rhetoric that couches itself in Christian language and symbols? If you can find agreement on some of these core principles, the semantics matter less than the concepts. So this is actually the most practical advice that she's given, and it's towards the very end of her book because her book's about 211 pages, and this is at page 197 and 198.
I mean, again, this is the appeal to equality argument. Again, that's not going to work going forward with the younger generation. That might work with a lot of boomers and Gen X who are kind of still vibed with this notion that you can have liberty and equality. Historically speaking, liberty and equality are actually juxtaposed to one another. You cannot have equality and liberty. You can either pick equality or you can pick liberty. America has chosen equality, which is why you're actually seeing your rights being eroded away.
Yes.
That's why
the Supreme Court is like the number one.
Yes, they're the number one instigator. That's why you have Canada like going after Sean Floyd, who's not even like the bastion of orthodoxy, but because he has a cross, you know, he's associated with Christianity, and therefore the state is going to go after him because they're all about equality. That's equality right there. That's what equality gets you. equality gets you, you know, a country that doesn't actually support you. It support because it has to support all peoples equally. It can't support the heritage Americans more than it supports the other groups. Which, again, if you had liberty, again, if you can look at Britain as a case study of what happens when you do away with your aristocrats, is they have a police state. They have a nanny state. You know, the church is heavily oppressed there. The church is practically dead in England.
Yeah, and they just elect, didn't the Church of Wales just elect a, like a gay, a lesbian, like,
yeah, lesbian, or something like that? I think I saw a process he ran that, like, Spurgeon's College or whatever is shutting down. So, yeah, if you want to see what happens when you do away with your aristocrats, that England is a perfect example. You know, they have a police state.
Also doesn't hurt that they, it also doesn't help that, you know, eugenics is kind of real in the sense that a population can get, like, all their masculinity wiped out in a war. Or if you're India, I think there's, like, a specific caste event. But, like, yeah, you think of, like, all these Europe, like, France, they lost it in Napoleon's era.
Well, two World Wars, too. Because they lost a lot of soldiers in World War
I. I thought I said... I thought I was plural there, but, yeah. Yeah, they, like, so, like, the English masculinity crisis, I think, is, like, largely a eugenics thing, as well as, like, the French and the Germans. Like, because the Germans are, like... They lost all their soldiers. Yeah. They lost the masculine... They lost the masculinity in their culture got culled through war. So, and that's definitely going to happen to Ukraine. Like, 50 years from now, it's probably going to be a very effeminate nation. Just my prediction. If they're not, like, completely consumed by Russia, that's probably their fate. One last quote that I wanted to share from this book, and it just... So she compliments Maxwell Frost, and I believe his name is Maxwell Alejandro Frost, but she kind of drops that to make him sound more Anglican, I guess. Anglo-Saxon, I think. Florida congressman. Man, where's the part? So that is why I found Speaker Johnson's words concerning. So we have reached levels of concern by the anti-Christian nationalists by claiming that God is the one who raises up those in authority and that God has ordained every member of Congress. He suggested that the U.S. House of Representatives is a religious body and not a secular one. He has merged Christian and American identities, and not just for himself, but everyone sitting in that chamber, many of whom were not Christians.
So she does not believe Romans 13, which asserts that, like, magistrates are ministers of God.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like, this is the level of Rachel.
You're not even Maddow. Like, you're not even like a New Testament. What is she, a red letter Christian at this point?
I don't know what part of the Bible she believes as authoritative. Because she clearly doesn't want to touch Romans, especially Romans 13.
She probably doesn't like touching anything. She probably does not like touching anything written by Paul.
Right. She ain't going to touch Paul with a 39.5-foot pole because she is a Grinch as far as a writer goes. Like, as far as an intellect goes, yeah. I got to think that Rachel Maddow could do better. But she's mad that Mike Johnson alluded to a Bible verse. Which is true, by the way. And then she took a wild interpretation that was like, oh, he was making this a religious body. It's like, he absolutely did not do that. He was speaking on the providence of God, which the Declaration of Independence appeals to the providence of God. So, for most in Blackbear. So Hitler was a... authority raised up by God for Germany, yes, as was Biden for the United States, who was worse, by the way. I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding, but, you know.
He affected me, so, yeah.
Yeah, Biden has done more to harm me than the mustache man did, that's for sure. And then, yeah, and the Democrats, yeah, their whole party is just nuts. So, yeah, that's kind of the gist of the book, like, kind of made it through. We made it through. I am hoping I am not dumber for having read this. I thought that this would be a little bit more intellectually compelling, but it really wasn't. There was no real arguments there. And I guess that might be my biggest surprise in reading this book, was that she was blue anon every conspiracy theorist, every liberal conspiracy theory, and there was just nothing there. Like, she was vacuous when it came to history and when it came to theology. And, you know, it was Constantine messed up, so Martin Luther King Jr. had to deliver the 99 Theses. Like, that's her view of church history.
No, again, she's not even, like, taking a more Paul Miller approach where it's just like, yeah, you can probably, you know, decently define Christianity.
It was not Paul Miller that was cited in her book. It was Stephen Perry and Andrew Whitehead, I think, were cited in her book.
I know I've heard of them, but I don't know what their work is.
Stephen Perry or something. Yeah, like, that's who's cited in her book.
But yeah, she's not even, like, at their level where they might tacitly understand what Christian nationalism is. It's just that they disagree with it for various reasons that generally, you know, are something along the lines of, well, religious freedom is biblical, or what about the Jews, which is, you know, pretty much a lot of what the opposition
to Christian nationalism. I didn't include this on the thread, but I did make like an every single time update where, yeah, she was encouraged to oppose Christian nationalism by a leader of a Jewish group. So every single time. But she's also married to a,
it's like, do you have a bell next to you as you're reading it? So you can just every single time just ring the bell.
I mean, she does talk about how the Black church and Jews teamed up together for the civil rights movement. She does say that. I'm like, oh, so the civil rights movement was Jewish and done wonders for the Black community.
I mean, yeah, MLK speechwriter, ring the bell. He was one.
Really?
Yes. So
is that why he was accused of plagiarism?
It might actually be.
Well, I didn't even know that. Like,
no, I mean, when they released some of the screenshots of the paperwork, you can see that that particular member's name was in the paperwork of being associated with him and the Communist Party. So yes. But yes, if you think, oh, well, yes, even the civil rights movement, yes.
And like, yeah, and there's just nothing here in this book. And keep in mind, so her definition of Christian nationalism, a political ideology and cultural framework that seeks to fuse American and Christian identities. That's her definition of Christian nationalism, but she credits Constantine as a Christian nationalist who is not an American. Like it's not, she didn't even create a universal definition. Like, there's just nothing here. So, let's do some chats before we head out, because I think that's kind of all. Cool dude with the super chat. Thank you, man. The hysteria over Christian nationalism is absurd. How can you look around and see how bad things are and not think things need to change drastically? Great channel. Thanks for the compliment. Yeah, I completely agree.
Oh, it's because you're
I saw 2022 and how the Constitution did not save us and the people didn't care and Americans didn't suffer enough and said, yeah, I don't think we can constitution our way out of this. And that I think that was the impetus for Christian nationalism's like ascendancy or reascendancy. Cause I would agree with Amanda Tyler that, hey, this actually predates, you know, 2022. And then right after that election, I believe is when, Stephen Wolf's book was published.
Yeah. Yeah. 2022
was, Wolf. So,
yeah, I mean, if you're looking at, things got very bad during COVID. So everyone became, I won't say radicalized, but yeah, you had a lot of people, you know, having to do some soul searching. And again, if your political beliefs did not change after 2020, are you an NPC, or were you just like right on every single thing the entire time? Which again, even though I was, you know, skeptical from the beginning, I've still changed quite a bit on political beliefs and even theological beliefs. So I would say you haven't grown as a person if you think you've been consistent through
the last
10 years.
Yeah, if your beliefs are the same, and I'm not talking about convictions, but if your beliefs, like your micro versus macro on politics haven't changed, like your belief of the methods of politics hasn't changed in the last 10 years, I don't think you've grown as a person. Methods, not
And yeah, things have gotten worse. You can't constitution your way out of it. In fact, in many ways, the Constitution does not actually protect your rights. If you require millions of dollars in legal fees to get a Supreme Court judge to basically write a favorable opinion that's in the majority, if that's what it takes to protect your rights, I mean, that's not actually a document protecting
your rights. And that's called lawfare.
Yes, that's the process is the punishment. Even if you win, the process is the punishment.
And thank you, Greg, for the super chat as well. And then I guess that's all we got for tonight. Don't need to keep you too much longer. So anyway, hope that was a helpful rundown of the worst book of 2025. And it turns out you can judge a book by its cover, because look how bad that is. How to End Christian. And because she crossed out the nationalism, she circled End. How to End Christian. It's a Freudian slip of a book. And, you know, but anyway, that's all we got for today. Have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.